Hello, my finest friends. Welcome to my podcast feed, powered by Acast Plus. Here's a joke from my son. What did the bum say to the other bum? That's a bummer. You know, not for everyone. Look, thanks to everyone who's come to see the previews of Can I Have My Ball Back? It's been going really, really well, and I'm really pleased with how the show's turning out. It's officially on tour now from Wednesday. I'll be at the Leicester Square Theatre. A couple of tickets left. Lots of press coming to that one. It'd be lovely to sell out, but there are a few other London gigs not selling as well. So if you're going to come to London, maybe look up those other London gigs. And then this week I'll be in St Albans on Thursday, Gloucester on Friday, Chorley on Saturday, which is sold out, but you can join the waiting list, and Glasgow on Sunday. Two shows. I think the earlier show is sold out. Check with the venue, but the later show has some availability. Come along if you can. If you enjoy these podcasts and like them being free, then the great way to pay me back is to buy a ticket to a show or buy a download or a book from gofasterstripe.com. But you can just keep listening for free as well. That pays me back also. So, you know, no pressure. But I'd love to see you there. If you just know me from the podcast and don't know me as a stand-up, I'm pretty good as a stand-up. It's a good show. I think you're going to enjoy it. It's only made about seven men faint so far. So, you know, are you brave enough to take the challenge? Let's sit back, relax, and enjoy whichever podcast you're listening to now.
Since 2013, Bombas has donated over 100 million socks, underwear, and T-shirts to those facing homelessness. If we counted those on air, this ad would last over 1,157 days. But if we counted the time it takes to make a donation possible, it would take just a few clicks. Because every time you make a purchase, Bombas donates an item to someone who needs it.
Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase. That's bombas.com/ACAST, code ACAST.
Everyone knows therapy is great for solving problems, but getting therapy has its own problems too, like finding the right therapist, fitting into their schedule, and of course, the cost. Well, BetterHelp can solve those problems. It's totally online and built around your schedule. It's surprisingly affordable too. Connect with a credentialed therapist by phone, video, or online chat, all from the comfort of your home. Visit betterhelp.com to learn more and save 10% on your first month. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.
Hello and welcome to another Rahulas to My Book Club. I am delighted to have read the wonderful Unruly by the equally wonderful David Mitchell, who joins me now. Hello, David.
Hello.
Lovely to see you. I hope you're very well.
I am. Thank you.
Look, this book, I didn't quite know. I mean, I sort of knew what to expect to an extent, and then to an extent it should have been what I expected, but I didn't know how serious. It's obviously a book about the kings and queens of England. To a certain point. And I didn't know if it's, you know, a lot of comedians and comedy people are writing serious history books, and sometimes they write comedy history books. And this is sort of both, but I think it skews more towards being an actual history book, I would almost argue.
Well, I mean, I hope that it tells you the main things about the kings and queens of England and not just the things that are funny about them, you know what I mean? And I want not to be in the territory of how disgusting the loos were in the Middle Ages, or how or how weird the forms of execution, or how the, you know, just all the gore and the poo, because ultimately I don't know, I'm too old and boring to find that funny anymore, and I genuinely find the dysfunctional nature of of a form of government where someone is arbitrarily in charge because of the family they're in, more funny than the disgusting ways they found to poo out of a castle and how naive they were by a bacterial infection.
It really does bring that home. I mean, it's obviously something most people will have questioned at some point, hopefully, about whether the royal family is necessary or how it came about. But this book really does sort of make you think about the random nature of both of history and the royal family, and the I would say at least thuggish beginnings of that institution.
Yeah, I mean, I think the thing is, obviously, I've got no problem with the royal family at all. because what they're doing is they're, you know, parading about and opening things and making supportive remarks at times of national crisis, and that's fine. I'm not a Republican, but at the same time, I think if they were still, you know, in charge to the extent that the Prime Minister is, I think that really is a problem. And what I find, I think most people agree with that, and that's a mainstream view. And what I find funny is that in the Middle Ages, that's not what people thought. they went along with it, with the idea of the person who is the king being the king, and there's not much you can do about that. And they really found it difficult and upsetting when the king was terrible or foolish or greedy or angry. And they thought, well, what can you do? He's the king, and that's the system. That's what God wants. And the notion that God wanted this had sort of been cooked up from nowhere. You know, even if you take it as a given that God exists, which, again, is not necessarily the assumed view now, but even if you did, there was really no evidence that this definitely existing God had said, and this is how you should order your society. And in fact, I think most of the people who are convinced God exists now would claim that God was much more in favour of democracy and that kind of thing.
Yeah. It is interesting that it shows, I suppose, that human nature accepts what is placed before it. So the trick for all of these people was that the first ones who established this, once it had gone a generation or two, you were just born into it and thought, oh, this is how it is. Yes. So we have to carry on.
Yes, it's just a few people early on who thought, I'll tell you what I might start to put about, is that, you know how I tend to be in charge of my local area because I beat the crap out of anyone who disagrees with me? What I need to do to make this a little bit lower pressure on me as the arthritis builds up in my fist, and I start to look askance at my head henchman who reckons he could take me now. What I need to get across is the idea that it's not just about me and my fists, but also that God thinks I should be in charge. And it's a, you know, it's a big notion. It's a big ballsy notion. And some key people early on in history managed to make people go along with it. And so, as you say, then their children, grandchildren, great-grandchildren, they go along with it as well. And so you have poor old Charles I, who's not included in the book because it's after it ends. But poor old Charles I, absolutely convinced as anyone can be that he's supposed to be in charge of everything, despite his manifest failings. And he carried on thinking that right up to and past the point where people chopped his head off for causing so much fucking trouble. And you just, you know, you've got to feel sorry for the guy.
Well, yeah, but I think I sort of end up feeling sorry for all of them. In the same way, when you watch The Crown, you kind of think, oh, my God, these poor people stuck in this awful kind of self-destructive thing where they can't love who they want, they can't do what they want. But all the way through this, you just get people. I mean, it's all about family and families who hate each other and or are so desperate for power that they kill each other and seem unaware that the same fate will almost certainly be waiting for them at the end of their reign, however long that ends up being.
Yes. Now, the failing, you know, the dysfunction of family dynamics under the context of great power is made clear over and over again. But you know that with that, it's just like Succession, really.
They must believe it too. So it gets to the point, whoever came up with it probably didn't believe it and just used it as an excuse, but they believe it themselves. And it's hard to work out, really, with this, you know, having considered this, why they went, you know, why anyone sought it out, because you would just think then, you know, you'd have a slightly nicer standard of living and you might get people to do what you want. But the possibility of just being killed pretty suddenly, and all your family being killed and everyone you love being killed, seems to overweigh that to me, to having a nice bit of venison every now and again or whatever.
I don't think then there were many people having what we'd call a nice, relaxed, affluent life. I think that's a section of society that is open to quite a lot of people now. If they've got, nice place to live and they earn enough money, they can have a nice, and they'd sort of think, I don't really see with my, access to widescreen television and internet and holidays in the sun and you know, and nice meals out every now and then. I don't feel the need to be in charge of the whole country. Most people think, but I suppose in that, those days, even the richest lived a horrendously uncertain and uncomfortable life. There was no TV to watch, very few books to read. So you might as well, you know, just to pass the time, you might as well try and be the king, particularly if that seems to be the family business.
You're not I
think what I want to go off and do is write ballet, because those words mean nothing. Ballet hasn't been invented.
And so, David, we'll talk about some of the issues in the book, and some of the fun in the book. What was it that... I mean, this is a big task to take on. And again, I wasn't until I received the book, I had the PDF to begin with. I wasn't sure how chunky a book is. It's a chunky book. There's a lot to go into it. I wasn't sure whether you were coming up to the present day. I was about halfway through thinking he's going to have to get a move on. He's going to get Queen Elizabeth II into this when I had the PDF. What was it that made you want to take this on? Because it seems to me like there's a lot of research or a lot of knowledge in there, even to... You've got to research each of these kings, and we're going back to the Anglo-Saxon kings as well, at least a bit, to be able to write this book. You need to know a lot about English history. Why did you want to take this on?
Well, I mean, it's partly I'm a contrarian. I was supposed to do history as a student, and what I did then is comedy.
Yes, and me too.
Now, you're now supposed to do comedy. Obviously, I'm hugely drawn to research and history, and yeah, that's just because I'm a difficult person. But it was basically during the end. I spent most of the lockdown not writing anything, and thinking this would be a perfect time to write things. Why am I not writing anything? And I think that was, you know, a lot of people felt that. And then I read a great book called Germania by a chap called Simon Winder, and it's a quite funny, jokey, sort of really interesting, anecdotal sort of history of Germany and the German area. And I loved it. And I loved how he wove in things from his own life and how I just chuckled a lot through it. And I usually, whenever I've done anything creative, it's because I'm trying to make another one of something I've liked. Right. So when I wrote sketches, because I liked the two Ronnies and Monty Python, that sort of thing. And I thought, I like this book. I'd like to make my own. And I've spent a long time telling myself I'd write a brilliantly funny whodunit, but actually I'm not going to do that because I don't know how. So I sort of feel I know a bit of history and I like it. I like the sort of, it's a terrible word, but I do like the quirkiness of it. And I'm going to try and write something in this tome. And because, you know, I'm not allowed out. So here I am with my computer. And I started typing basically about the Vikings. Because I thought it reminded me of COVID, and I thought it was quite funny. You know, it wasn't funny at the time, but the idea you have this relatively settled, but quite barbaric area of England, and then suddenly some Vikings started arriving with no warning and being absolutely horrible to everyone and nicking their stuff and killing them and pushing them over. Nobody knew why it started. Nobody knew how to stop it. And it was pretty much like COVID. And I just sort of started typing a bit about what that was like, or what I imagined that would be like.
Yes.
And then I took the story further forward, and then I thought, well, actually, it doesn't make sense to start with the Vikings. I'll start when England kind of started. And just for fun, really, I ended up typing about 30,000 words, which took it up to William the Conqueror.
Right.
And I thought, well, I've written an appreciable amount of a book. So publishers will believe I'll finish it in a way. If it was a 500 words treatment, they wouldn't. And so I thought, well, this is a nice position to be in. And I then, you know, approached some publishers and wrote the rest of the book. But it was sort of the key third of it just sort of happened. From just trying to write about something I vaguely knew about in the same tone as this book I loved,
Well, I mean, I wish all history books were like this. I am a fan of history books and I like serious history books. And this particular period of history is one that I've always, especially the really early part, is one I've always struggled to get my head around. And I've read quite a lot about it, but I forget it all. So this is A, to get it digestible into nice chunks, which explain the main points is good. But also, I think just the fun of you being obviously funny as you go, the digressions as you go. So, you know, there's sort of unexpected analogies with modern day, and there's, you know, you suddenly get angry about the latest James Bond film for quite a while, which you don't get in many history books.
I'm glad you saw that as a bonus, because I said there is no way, having got on this tangent about the latest disgraceful James Bond film, I thought there's no way I'm cutting this out of the book. We'll miss out William II rather than lose this bit. Who's going to miss William II?
William II is quite, it's good though.
William II, but if I'd missed him out, I stopped before William III.
Yeah.
And, you know, if you haven't got William III, then you're not going to spot there's a William II miss, really. But you could make the argument that in government cuts, we should be removing some of these kings whose history is so uninteresting.
Yes. Yeah, I mean, it's sort of in that, you know, that's one of the things that's great about it, is, you know, is remembering or finding out about things you didn't know about. I mean, the one with the I'd never heard until I read about this period for a while. And again, it's annoying because the stuff you do when you're 18 or 16 sticks in your brain forever. And if you try as a 50-year-old to learn about the Middle Ages, you just find you read three books about it and then you've forgotten nearly everything that you've But there's the younger king. There's two kings running together. I can't remember. Is it Henry the younger king or Edward the younger? So it's one of the... A king gets sort of coronated by his dad during his reign, and they sort of rule together. And I'd forgotten about him until you reminded me. But yeah, so it's I think, you know, you bringing in your personal life, your personal gripes, and also what I like is you're allowed to be you're allowed to be partial. You're allowed to say when you very much do not like Edward the Confessor, I think it's fair to say. Yeah. And most historians don't get the luxury of just being able to rag on one of the historical figures throughout their book.
Edward the Confessor has projected down the ages this sort of image of a tremendously pious, thoughtful man.
Yeah.
And he just decided, it's very modern in a way. He just decided that's who I am. That's what I'm going to endlessly project on the equivalent of his Instagram. And that all the historians have bought it. That he, you know, and what he was tricksy and weak and difficult and lavish. Yeah. And I have no sympathy for the man at all. He refused ever to have sex with his wife, and yet that, which is a tremendous domestic cruelty, really, when you think about her life devoted to this man, she'd barely touch her. Why is that? Holy. That's just manipulative.
Yes.
I've always liked history books. I'm interested in history, except for a 3-year period when the local education authority was paying for me to study it. But what I've always wanted to know is what happened before this thing and what happened afterwards. I've never particularly wanted to know exactly the details of precisely why something was. I'm very much a what happened next. Sort of history fan, and I hope this is a what happened next kind of history. If you just want to know, okay, and let's get through it. Okay, there's Magna Carta. I vaguely get the idea. We could get into the total details of exactly what that meant, but more interesting than that is what happened because of it just afterwards. And that's my approach. So hopefully, if you want the in-depth stuff, it's 1,000 years of history. So it's only a 400-page book, so you really need to read several other books.
I wonder if all history books were like this, and, you know, certainly for younger people getting into history, but and anyone really, this is a much more interesting way of doing it. And then if you found something, I read a brilliant book a very interesting book about the White Ship. I think it was by Lady Diana's brother. I think it was by Earl Spencer.
Yes, I read it as well. That's very good.
Yeah. If you are interested in the White Ship, which most people probably won't know about, but again, it's what I thought that, you know, there's a lot of moments in history, as this book shows, just because people die so randomly, history would be very different in lots of different ways. But if there was a sliding doors moment in history, it's King Stephen having the shits while it shouldn't be sliding doors. It should be having the shits while the white ships
liquid shit.
Yeah, the white shit. So that moment where basically all of the nobility of England were wiped out, apart from the man who had diarrhea and couldn't get on the ship, or the young nobility, is an absolutely fascinating moment of history. You cover it very well, but if you were interested in that, you can find another book about it and go, this is all the stuff that happened. But I think that's, that's what this really sparked off on me, was thinking, the randomness of those moments of the people who could have been king and how things would have been different, or if battles had gone slightly differently. I mean, if Harold's soldiers hadn't run down the hill after William's soldiers at the Battle of Hastings, or if the last one I've just read, King Henry VIII chapter, if Anne Boleyn had put out, that would be a very interesting alternate history of the UK, but you would never get there. It would be better for her, I think, if she put out, and it would have been different for the rest of us had she put out.
Essentially, the self-respect she showed as someone who wasn't willing to have a random affair with Henry VIII basically caused the English Reformation and then the deaths of that. Now, you can't blame her for that. But it's an odd side effect of what you'd say if you were her friend or relative. You'd say, you're quite right. you're a worthwhile person. If Henry's serious about you, then let him show it. Don't just be his bit on the side. But actually, as you say, for human history, if she'd just gone along with that, she wouldn't have been beheaded, and neither would 300 Protestants have been burned by Bloody Mary.
That, yes.
Butterfly's wings, isn't it?
But it's unimaginable that one person's decision in history, it's unimaginable what the world would have turned out like. And that's sort of the interesting thing about Hitler, history and Hitler. It always comes back to Hitler. The interesting thing about history...
Hitler is not really mentioned in the book.
It doesn't get a mention. That's what I was surprised about. The Longshanks and Scotland, his decision to go after Edward's decision to go after the Scottish, the repercussions that we have as a result of that one man's stupid decisions is extraordinary. But if he hadn't done it, something else would have happened, and it might have been worse, it might have been better. So it's those sort of what ifs of history are sort of pointless in a sense. But there, it is fascinating how. Because I think, again, with kings and queens, you think, you still have an idea that they were meant to be there, or that there was a reason behind it, or that they were in control. And I think when you really just look at it, from a slight distance, you go, all of this is just a load of random shit. Someone died of food poisoning or dysentery and changed the course of human history. It's crazy.
The difference of how death worked in that society is really weird. And I remember somebody saying, there was a good program on Radio 4 about statistics, and of saying how basically the elderly nowadays are looked after better really than they have been at any point in history. And yet we feel now that the elderly are in an unfortunate position. Care homes are under pressure, this sort of thing. And one of the reasons for that is that now old people have a near monopoly on death. And so rather than that, what being old used to represent in the Middle Ages was being a survivor. It represented life. You're someone who cheated death. You weren't one of the many people who died in childhood or in middle age. You represent life. Now the notion of being old represents death. And it's obviously a side effect of something very good, that we have much longer life expectancy. It does mean that all the deaths seem to cluster in the older generation.
Yes.
But throughout the period covered by the book, somebody could just, they seem absolutely fine, and then they're anywhere, at any age at all, and then just they are suddenly dead, either in a day or in 3 months. Like Edward IV, very good king, very effective, not a great diet, and he just suddenly got really ill and realised, I've got about 3 weeks to live. He tried to write a will, that none of it worked out. It was just randomly eclipsed. And it still obviously still happens, but it happens much, much more rarely. But they lived with it all the time. And obviously, that's why they tried to say, oh, no, it's all God. This isn't a terrifying, crazy, painful world where at any moment everything could be taken from you, either by war or famine or plague. No, no, this is part of a plan too intricate and amazing for us to fully understand. And you know, it's sort of human nature to sort of cling to some sense of order and, you know, out of that chaos. And we can chaos more because actually we enjoy more of an ordered society.
Yes, and the thing I hadn't really thought about, which again this book made me think about, was the primogeniture is kind of a ridiculous way to rule in a lot of ways. Obviously just going the oldest kid will be the best, and is obviously not the case. But it's actually in those circumstances and in a world where if there was any conflict over it, it would create a lot of problems, it's actually better just to know who it's going to be. Even if they turn out to be horrible, evil and terrible, it's still better than having an argument about who's going to come next.
The argument is definitely, the few years of argument is much, much worse than the several decades of suboptimal government.
Yes. So it's, you know, it's interesting how it did work, and it obviously, but it's interesting to me, again, not having really thought about it, how many years of it not really working. In fact, as the book ends, I think we sort of come into Henry VIII and Elizabeth I, who are pretty successful monarchs and pretty good monarchs up to an extent. But they come at exactly the right time in order to make the UK and England the force that it became. And any of the previous kings, really, and queens, or any of the previous times, there wasn't the stability or the knowledge to really get there. So those guys, luckily, sort of taking over, arguably the Tudors, came at the right time for us, even if Henry VIII did some things that would escalate into difficulties.
It feels like with the Tudors, they're very, because they were quite a random family to end up with the throne. They weren't really that royal, and they were quite lucky. And they do, even though they put out a lot of royal imagery, it feels like they do more understand that this is quite a small family business.
Yes.
What Elizabeth I in particular, she really manages her outgoings and doesn't try and start too many wars. She hasn't got any of Edward III or Henry V's sort of glorious attempts to conquer. It's just like, no, let's try and stay within budget, try not to annoy too many people. Look like you're doing your best to be a Protestant monarch and not, you know, and be on side with the other Protestant monarchs. But we let's not get too big for our boots. And you could sort of say that comes from them knowing that they're not really anointed by God at all. They're just a family that got given the keys to the kingdom by luck. And that sort of slight sense of sort of bourgeois mediocrity probably saved the country from another few random wars. Whereas for the 100 years before, they all seem to reckon they can conquer France. And you sort of go, how's that going to? France is massive. You know, it's just give up. You know, it's like constantly trying to dig a pond where the water drains too well. It's just you keep putting the water in, and in this case, the water is money and soldiers and, you know, and you just look away and it's gone dry. This is not a place for a pond. You can't run France from London. That's it. But I think that most of them, they sort of think, no, well, I'm anointed by God. I'm a bit magic. I can do anything.
Here's a cool fact. A crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Another cool fact, you can get short-term health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans are designed for people who are between jobs, coming off their parents' plan, or turning a side hustle into a full-time gig. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. Get more cool facts about UnitedHealthcare short-term plans at uh1.com.
This message comes from BOF sponsor eBay. You'll know real when you get it. It'll say eBay Authenticity Guarantee. And you'll feel it. Maybe it's a head-turning handbag, a watch that says it all, jewelry that makes you look like the gem, or sneakers and streetwear so fresh every step feels fly. eBay gets it. So look for the blue check mark next to that thing you love and be confident that every inch, stitch, sole, and logo is checked by experts. With eBay Authenticity Guarantee, you can trust that feeling of real is always in reach. Ensure your next purchase is the real deal. Visit ebay.com for terms.
This is Paige, the co-host of Giggly Squad, and I want to tell you about a company that I've been loving, Olive & June. Olive & June gives you everything that you need for a salon-quality manicure in one box. And if you break it down, it really comes out to $2 a manicure, which is absolutely insane. It's also so easy to get salon-worthy nails at home with Olive & June. The difference between how your nails used to look when you did them yourself and now with the Manny system is a complete game changer. The best thing about Olive & June, too, is it's a quick dry. It dries in about 1 minute, lasts for 5 days, and full coverage in up to 1 to 2 coats. Visit oliveandjune.com/perfectmanny20 for 20% off your first system. That's oliveandjune.com/perfectmanny20 for 20% off your first system.
It is, you know, it is. You're right. The funniness of it, as well as you do. I mean, you're almost, as you say, I think you're almost contractually obliged to make jokes about Canut, King Canut.
Yes.
Though you avoid making jokes about Clito. You don't do any clit jokes.
Yeah.
So we weren't well done for stepping away from that one.
Yes.
There are lots of funny, rude and silly things, but what this book does really excellently, I think, is just show the, as you do when you do political stuff about now, but from the distance, it just shows the utter ludicrousness of the whole of society, and everything that everyone's doing is pointless and stupid. Why the trying to fight wars? Why fighting for this sort of poison chalice? Why did people basically accept it? It is sort of the peasants' revolt's very interesting that there was this moment where there might have been revolution, but they still basically had respect for the king, so it didn't happen.
That's the moment you sort of see a slight glimmering of something egalitarian or even socialist in some of the language. And as you say, and then they definitely hate the aristocracy and lords and all that. They reckon those are just parasites, but they haven't quite got to the point of also hating the king. And it's still all about the king is badly advised. The king is a good person. If he just could hear our grievances, he'd help. At this point, the king is an extremely spoilt child, and it absolutely would not help at all. He would find them revolting. I mean, they were revolting, but he'd find them revolting in every sense. Just to redo that joke that's been done 1,000 times. But they still believe in him, and that's because I suppose you've got to believe in something, because otherwise it is just a sort of chaos of mud and disease.
Yeah, I mean, the whole book makes me very happy. I live now, and almost I can't think of any time, even the 1950s. I don't think I'd like to live in. But it's incredible how basic and unpleasant and awful life must have been for most people. It's sort of interesting. I mean, a lot of people have tried to write histories about, especially nowadays, trying to find the history of the normal people or of people who are left behind by history. So it's an interesting choice to go to the kings in a way and the monarchs in a way, because obviously that's, but I guess it's easier as well because there's some history.
Because they've left all of the records, we just know more about them. And I'll be honest,
it really is interesting. And I'm not a royalist. I don't really certainly see the need for the royal family now. And I don't think it's very fair on them. I think they have a pretty horrible time. But it is really fascinating. And it's got, I guess, and you do touch on this as well, but history itself is the things that get remembered in history are nearly always things that didn't actually happen. You talk about Alfred burning the cakes, which is probably something that didn't happen. But that's just a really boring story. But that's the thing most people would know. His life, if most people said, what did he do? They go, he burnt the cakes. And that's really what he's remembered for. So that's, and it didn't happen. And as you say, it's it's boring. So history is such an interesting, you know, interesting thing in that the way some stories stick and why they stick and what they represent is.
Genuinely, the thing I first remember being told about the Vikings was that they didn't have horns on their helmets, and I found it annoying then, and I find it annoying now, because it's such a brilliant image, the Viking with the helmet horns, and it deserves to be true, right? And I feel it's metaphorically true. It's a sort of greater poetic insight into what the Viking was than any image of them without the horns on the helmet. And I would be, I'm not so, you know, in this post-truth age, let's enjoy ourselves a bit and just give the Vikings those horns.
I also like, there's a lot about Simon de Montfort. It was always a character that Stuart and I found amusing, although he isn't very, we always talked about him for a lot. I like the fact you just start calling him SDM. I enjoy that rather than writing it out. So it shows you hit your word count. The story of his demise, where his head and testicles, is that right? It's him, isn't it? Is sent to by Roger Mortimer.
His balls were arranged over his head. Head chopped off, balls chopped off. I think I don't know what happened to the penis, but they were draped, and then one of the guys that won the battle sent this to his wife as a sort of, I don't know, as a sexy offering, as you know, sort of. This is why I've been so busy with it.
You said I'd never amount to anything. Here it is. Yeah. I told you it would work out.
And it's odd because particularly around then, they're all, so around the time of Henry III and Edward I, they're so pious. They're really religious people. And they really buy the whole anointed thing, and they're really into their religion. Which, to the extent that they're enthusiastic anti-Semites, and that, you know, so in this, in the mid all this piety, the sudden sending of head and testicles, you sort of go, isn't that a clash? But it wasn't for them. It wasn't a tonal clash between all the God and Jesus is wonderful stuff to in this person who's wrong. It's all part of that to send their genitals and
to your own wife. I mean, if it had been Simon de Montfort's partner, would that have been worse? I mean, it would have been, but it's sort of as you make the point, it is an odd thing to receive and to try and interpret. But maybe she understood. Maybe they had a secret understanding of what that meant between the two of them. The ball straight. It's an ignominious end to a life of ups and downs. He wasn't a very nice person by modern standards, but it had a university named after him. So,
I'm not sure. I mean, he was a prominent figure associated with the Leicester area, although definitely not in any sense from the Leicester area. I don't know quite how. I mean, they really haven't got beyond the Ladybird book on Simon de Montfort. great to name the university after. It also slightly implies that maybe he founded the university when in fact it was hundreds of years later that he founded it. You sort of go, okay, well, maybe, you know, he can call it after himself. But to actually name it after someone who was that, you know, let's say that much of a complicated man seems
well, and I like the fact that you talked about there were like seven Simon de Montforts or something in a row, right, by father, which is a weird thing to do, isn't it, to name, I mean, people still do it, to name, George Foreman named all of his sons George Foreman and then had to, he had to give them nicknames to differentiate between them. He had about eight sons.
Somebody needs to explain that they get the larger part of them name automatic. Yes. That sense of them belonging to your family, that's all, the system has factored that in. And now what you need to do is come up with the names so that you can refer to them individually.
That doesn't
explain. I'm calling them all George Foreman, but then, oh no, it turns out I do need the extra name. What you're calling the nickname George Foreman, that's the name. What you're calling the name, that's the surname. And that's, you know, things. Yeah. But yes, I always find it odd when people call their children, give them their names. It feels like it's an attempt at immortality, attempt to sort of...
It doesn't work because as the final Simon de Montfort didn't have a son, so the Simon de Montforts passed away.
There's no current Simon de Montfort, so there was no Simon de Montfort around to be a nice liberal academic and actually found that university in a way that would have made sense for it to be named after him.
But I was reading about W.H. Smith the other day, so I wrote a blog about W.H. Smith, and the original W.H. Smith died like 2 months after W.H. Smith started. But then his sons were called W.H. Smith, but with the different names, but their initials are W.H. Smith. So I guess that in that sense, W.H. Smith carried on. It's maybe do the initials if you want to do it, because then everyone can feel they're W.H. Smith. But it's sort of weird if you're all the same name Smith.
Yeah, that's a more moderate way of being a cross-generational narcissist. Yeah. I just went with my initials.
There's loads of enjoyable... analogies with the present day. You compare Henry III to Macaulay Culkin. I enjoy that. I've just read about Joan of Arc, who you describe as doing a reverse Savile, which I think is it's rather lovely. But those things do they're funny, but they really work as a way of bringing to life what actually happened, I think, as well. So if someone is actually, I think this is a great present to give someone studying history, because, you sort of want the basics in there, and then you can, as you say, we can do more work around that. I don't think anyone doing a university degree in Anglo-Saxon history should only read this book.
I would be very interested if anyone would like to do that experiment and just only read this half a book about the Anglo-Saxons and see if they could get a degree from that alone and whatever came to them from their general life.
It wouldn't be far off what I did. I think I nearly did that experiment for my history degree. I almost read one book. Mine was the history of the later Middle Ages by, I forget his name, I shoplifted the history of the Middle Ages. So I got into the Richard and the Lollards, whichever Richard that was, the second, was it? I can't even remember now, but I suddenly had an interest. I read one book, but it was one proper history book. So yeah, we'll try. Let's do an experiment. I'm going to have one of my children sent to university to do history, but only allow them to read your book and see how they do.
I'd love to see how that went. And then afterwards, if they do get a decent degree, then we could discuss why that university should then be closed.
It'll be De Montfort University. I'll send them to De Montfort University to do that.
I do, hopefully, when I, because I find the bits of history that I think are the funny side of it, I find it easier to remember. Yes. But I think about Henry II and how he couldn't get on with his sons or his wife. The funny side of that makes it memorable. Yes. But genuinely, I find Simon de Montfort easier to remember for the fact of him being, not a nice liberal founder of Parliament, but a religious extremist and anti-Semite and warmonger. That funny contrast between his reputation in Victorian eyes and who he really was is memorable. Yeah. If there's nothing funnier about a king, that's it's harder to remember who they were and why they
matter. That in all these things, and a lot of comedians have ended up writing books, and some of them are more serious than others and about serious subjects or academic subjects. But I think just inject it, and some of them are deliberately funnier than others, and some of them are actually quite serious. But I think just by injecting that, making it entertaining. I can imagine like fusty academics being annoyed with you for writing this book, even though I think you are quite a fusty academic as well. So there's only just a degree, it absolutely means you're engaged and it's fun. So if there's a little digression about what you're up to at the or something that's happened to you in amongst this history, then I think it really helps cement it. I still can't remember any of the names of the Anglo-Saxon kings though, so it hasn't worked or what they did.
Just all D's, R's, A's and E's. It's like the noise of 1,000 years of sneezing. I don't know. But the thing as well about the Anglo-Saxons is that they, you know, for a long time, the historians told us that there were seven Anglo-Saxon kingdoms, this heptarchy, and they didn't know. That was what, at the end of the Anglo-Saxon age, that was what vaguely existed. But the historians for a long time sort of said, yeah, the Anglo-Saxons came and they set up seven kingdoms. We go, no. Well, they came and they sort of stole land from the people who were there already. They were too superstitious to even live in any of the Roman towns that had been built because they thought that wasn't safe. Maybe they had a sort of premonition of the issue with Britain's schools today. They thought that hasn't been properly maintained. The budget hasn't been there. Maybe that's going to be the next stage of our civilization. We abandon buildings because they're no longer safe. But that's what the Anglo-Saxons did, and they just hung around, picked fights with each other, and then after ages of that kind of horrible chaos, there were seven kingdoms.
Yeah. I mean, you know, it's amazing the UK turned out to be as successful as it briefly was, but maybe not so amazing. Maybe understandable now that we're sort of sliding down the hill back towards the dark ages that we're not allowed to call them anymore. It's a really entertaining book. It's a really funny book. And I think you will learn stuff, you know. And I thought Richard of York, Gives Battle in Vain, I thought that was Richard III. I'd got confused him. Because he's the son of York. I thought they were the same person. And so that the book has reminded me that they are, in fact, Richard of York gave Battle in Vain is a different Richard of York than Richard of York.
That's what I think. But all we have is Richard of York, just those letters. So it could be... It could be me,
because I'm from Pocklington, which is near York. It could be I have given Battle in Vain, to be fair, throughout my life. So, yeah, I'll take it as myself.
It could be you, but then again, if it's you, then we have no way of remembering the rainbow before you were born.
That's true.
And sort of similarly, if Richard III, if people wanted to remember the rainbow for the 20 or 30 years between the Richard of York and Richard III, then they'd have to do it thinking of the previous one giving Battle in Vain.
There's probably always been a Richard giving Battle in Vain. That's probably always put there just in case.
There may have been a Red Wolf of Yeovil giving Battle in Vain.
Good work.
The Anglo-Saxon, in case people need to remember the rainbow there.
Good work. It is a trivia book. I ask everyone, are you reading anything you'd like to recommend, or have you read anything recently you'd like to recommend that isn't your own work?
I am, at the moment, I'm reading, very much enjoying Gorky Park.
Oh, wow.
The 1980, I think, thriller about the Soviet Union, which, because I've just got back from holiday, and that was the last of my pile of nice, appetizing holiday thrillers. I've also, before that, I was reading a May Gray. I love the May Grays. And before that, I read a book about the English Civil War. Which was called The Siege of Loyalty House, which is a bit more of a proper history book. It's only about the English Civil War, and it's a whole book about that. So that's more in depth than mine. So doing a history degree and reading that would be cheating.
Okay, but we won't allow anyone to do that. And I know you sort of give reasons at the end why you're stopping with Elizabeth I and the changes. Are you going to attempt to bring us up to date with another volume of this with the rest of the kings and queens?
I'd quite like the idea of doing another one, but I don't know whether I would stick so rigorously to being king and queen focused, because that's the thing. It doesn't really, you know. I mean, obviously, it's only many serious historians would say that it was an absolute, you know, it's a assault on their profession that I was so king or queen focused in this book. But to do it after 1603 gets increasingly ridiculous. And obviously, you know, I don't think writing the life of Charles III really tells the story of the times we're living in now.
I'd love to see you do it though, David. That's the when I was thinking, I didn't know how far you were going to go. I thought, I can't wait to see what he says about Queen Elizabeth II. And the distance, I think, as well. You do make the point that the kings and queens sort of are less at the centre of everything, I suppose, sort of less relevant than to. Once Shakespeare comes along, we have other people who are pushing history and art onwards. It would be nice to see you sum up King Charles III while he's still on the throne. So you better be quick, because it can't be long. Can't be long.
Yeah. I think that's treason. What you've just said is treason.
It's a sort of threat, isn't it? It's sort of like, it won't be long, Charles. Not if my plans, not if me and Prince Harry's plans come to fruition. Like to raise an army against him. I mean, they don't have that, at least, you know. They might not be able to marry who they love, and they might have horrible times, but they don't have to fight armies of their stepbrothers.
Yes.
Which is nice.
No, exactly. They have much easier ride. Some difficulties with fountain pens, but no one's trying to fire an arrow. Well, I say no, and obviously he has huge security, and I'm sure lots of terrorists would try and get an arrow into his eye if they could get that through the metal.
Yeah, detector. Well, good luck to them is what I say. And
I do not wish good luck to attempted assassins of the sovereign. I just
okay. Well, we differ on that. We'll agree to differ on that. Charles seems okay, but it'd be better if we didn't have a king. Yeah. So I will leave it there. Thank you, David, for joining us. That was really interesting. And thank you to Chris Evans and Ben Evans. And do go and buy, I'm sure you will anyway, Unruly. There's an audio book, presumably, David. Have you done?
Book, which I have read.
Yeah, how was that? Did you enjoy reading your own work out for 400 pages?
I enjoy some of it. I worried about, but in general, the great thing about reading it out is you're not trusting the reader to get the sentences
right.
True. This is how it should be read. You put the stress on this word.
Yes. I mean, you have to do it. There's no way you can go, I'm going to get somebody else in to do this one. It has to be David Mitchell reading it. I mean, it's so much in your voice anyway. It almost doesn't need, you could just put the audio book, you could put the book in the studio and the book would basically just read itself. It's so in your voice.
I can get Rob Brydon to do it. Very good impression of me. And it's more of a voiceover professional.
That's true. So. Well, maybe we should do two versions and people could choose which one they want. Thank you very much, David. Really lovely to see you again. We'll see you soon, I'm sure.
Yes, see you soon. Thanks, Richard. Cheers.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
This message comes from BOF sponsor eBay. You'll know real when you get it. It'll say eBay Authenticity Guarantee. And you'll feel it. Maybe it's a head-turning handbag, a watch that says it all, jewelry that makes you look like the gem, or sneakers and streetwear so fresh every step feels fly. eBay gets it. So look for the blue check mark next to that thing you love. And be confident that every inch, stitch, sole, and logo is checked by experts. With eBay Authenticity Guarantee, you can trust that feeling of real is always in reach. Ensure your next purchase is the real deal. Visit ebay.com for terms.
Imagine the softest sheets you've ever felt. Now imagine them getting even softer over time. That's what you'll feel with Bowl and Branch's organic cotton sheets. In a recent customer survey, 96% replied that Bowl and Branch sheets get softer with every wash. Start getting your best night's sleep in these sheets that get softer and softer for years to come. Try their sheets with a 30-night guarantee. Plus, get 15% off your first order at bowlandbranch.com. Code BUTTERY. Exclusions apply. See site for details.
Thanks again for listening to the podcast. RichardHerring.com/ballback/tour or RichardHerring.com/gigs for all of the information on the tour. GoFasterStripe.com for lots of downloads and books and lots of fun. Thanks for listening. Go and listen to another one. Tell your friends about the show. Tell your friends about the tour. I love you all. I'm out.